This podcast is part of the Deluxe Edition Network. To find other great shows on the network, head over to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. That's deluxeeditionnetwork.com.
Hoes, this is the podcast making public transit taking kiss stealing wheeling dealing son of a gun Tim the Nerd welcoming you to another episode of Friends Talking Nerdy, part of the Deluxe Edition Network. Head to deluxeeditionnetwork.com to find out more information about all of the lovely shows that are a part of that network. And seated next to me, we have the greatest legal mind in the Pacific Northwest. We have Professor Aubrey. How you doing?
I am good, Tim the Nerd. How are you?
I am very, very good. Now, one thing I know you wanted to bring up right away, and something that I've been talking about endlessly on the show for months, ever since we heard it was going to be a thing, is Dolly Parton's brand new album.
Dolly Parton has a new album out. That's right. It is called Rockstar, and it features many, many duets and collabs with original artists of rock and roll songs that Dolly covers. There is, of course, the one original Dolly song. There might be more than one, but the first song on the album is Rockstar by Dolly. And it is basically the plot of The Pick of Destiny, only in song, and the girl grew up in Appalachia instead of the Midwest.
No, there's a movie. Even though Jack Black didn't grow up in the Midwest, he was a Los Angeles kid. As a young kid, he was in a Nintendo commercial in the 80s.
Yeah, he was a child actor, and his parents are very involved in the industry. I don't know exactly in what capacity, but
you know,
live in Culver City, so.
I mean, having people, you know, family members in the industry just makes it easier for someone to dip their toe into the entertainment industry waters because they know what to do.
Yeah, it's just like if you have gone to college and your children, you're encouraging them to go to college. You're not only encouraging them to go to college, you're helping them by sharing your experiences going to college. So like when they go and their financial aid is screwed up, you can say, yeah, that happened to me once, but here's what I did. And I'm sure if you do X, you know, you were able to share that information. And when you don't have that conduit in your first generation college student, it's really hard because you don't know, you don't have any context for what's happening. And it's very bureaucratic and weird.
Exactly. I mean, especially because, I mean, something that a bit of knowledge about the industry that I think the average person may not have paid attention to until the SAG-AFTRA strike was the fact that most people working in Hollywood aren't making, you know, six figures, seven figures or more, you know, per job. A lot of them are just normal 9-to-5 people. You know, maybe they're getting paid, you know, like at low end, 40 to 50 thousand, but you know they're getting a good solid five figure salary, and you know I could certainly benefit from having a good high paying five figure salary or something like that. So you know I'm certainly jealous, but still, you're right, it is unique. But back to Dolly. You know, my initial thoughts on it are, It's not going to be an album that I'm probably going to listen to again. It was one of those deals that I really respected her motivation behind, you know, creating this album. I've said that ad nauseum on the show. You know, she didn't have to do this. She could have easily just accepted the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nomination and did her thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but she took it upon herself to say, if I'm being recognized by these people, I want to give them a reason to, you know, give me that recognition. And I thought she did a damn good job, especially due to the variety of rock artists she brought in. I mean, because she could have stuck with the classic rockers, got John Fogerty or, you know, whoever, which she did, to come play on it. But, you know, she also got, you know, her goddaughter, Miley Cyrus, on the album, plus Joan Jett, among others. Her cover of Freebird on the song uses it kind of touching back on the Now and Then thing, it features vocals from the lead singer of Lynyrd Skynyrd, who passed away. So she was able to do a duet, that way on there. So, I respect
I was also really impressed with the variety of people that she collaborated with for the album. I mean, she's got Lizzo on there. She's got Michael McDonald. Like, there's something going back, way back in the day, but not far enough back in the day, if you know what I'm saying. It's yet to reach classic status, I think, but it's sort of yacht rock, I guess.
What if the world believed? Something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. Oof.
Always be. Yeah, so.
Michael McDonald actually wrote a Van Halen song.
That's weird.
It's on the 1984 album. It's I'll Wait. I'll wait till your love comes down.
Oh, yeah, I know that one.
Yeah, that one.
Interesting.
Anyways, that's me singing. Totally derailing everything again. But what would you say would be your highlight of that album?
Probably just because of the mood I've been in, the Let It Be with Paul McCartney and Ringo. Just because I've been kind of obsessed with the Beatles lately. And so, you know, it's just a chance to hear them doing something new and, like, being okay with Dolly Parton. Being like, okay, we're big stars and we are, like, highly influential and we have a body of work and all of this. But we recognize that this other person is a superstar. This other person has, you know, their whole own audience. They have been innovative in their own style of music. And so it feels like a really respectful relationship.
Oh, to the Beatles' credit. I mean, you know, they, along with the Rolling Stones, and there are others as well, were very, very open about, you know, being as vocal as they could about the music that inspired them, that they liked. You know, Smokey Robinson, for instance, says that the Beatles cover of one of his songs on their second album with the Beatles, one, made him a lot of money, but two, the fact that they would go out in interviews and say, we heard this great album from Smokey Robinson, you should all check it out. He was able to grow his audience. You know, and so, yeah, it's a different situation with Dolly, but maybe not so much because, you know, there are hardcore country fans who are like the constant joke I keep on saying that's not funny anymore, but it makes me laugh. There are two types of music, country and Western. You know, there are people
now, you think there's going to be a backlash amongst the country fans out there who maybe are concerned that Dolly is losing her countryfiedness and becoming cityfied?
I don't think so. I mean, especially because, like, all she has publicly said about this whole experience is that it was her chance to pay it back to, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame by making a rock album. You know, I don't think, you know, we're going to see her, you know, making any more rock albums or whatever. But, you know, on the flip side, I could see this experience opening her up in future albums to collaborations that she may not have initially thought of. I mean, come on, Rob Halford and Dolly Parton did a duet.
Right.
And think of the positives that, you know, a country artist of her stature could do in terms of opening people's minds about, you know, at the very least, respecting another artist.
Yeah, and certainly this sort of curated by Dolly rock and roll songs will, you know, could be some of the rock and roll songs that those country fans know, like the few they're going to know in the future because they were on Dolly's album.
Yeah, and I think her being a student of music, I think she also understands that at the end of the day, the labels we put on music are were put on there by companies trying to, you know, classify music as a product. You know, music is music at the end of the day. The only reason we call rock and roll is, again, to say songs that sound like this all fit into this group.
I mean, it's interesting. The algorithm does that for us now. And so we don't even have styles of music anymore. We just have the algorithm.
And that got me to thinking, too, because like I mentioned that it was either last week or the week before that Colin Hanks documentary, All Things Must Pass, about Tower Records. And it was the rise and fall. I mean, everybody's at least familiar with the name. Maybe, you know, they haven't gone there. But I did go to the original Tower Records when I lived in Sacramento. I stopped there once and bought a Pete Townshend Greatest Hits album.
Hey.
Yeah, but he talked about at the end of Tower Records' run, he realized the mistake it was going all in on the album format. Because what iTunes ended up doing, what Napster ended up doing, is getting people back in the mindset of what records initially were, singles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, occasionally an album would come out, but generally people would be buying a bunch of 45s, you know, spending like a dollar or two to get that one song. And, you know, with modern technology the way it is, it's the same thing, just clicking and downloading at that point. And if more record stores had a little more foresight in terms of, you know, how they sell the product. I mean, maybe they could have had like a computer stations that, you know, was specifically made computers that people can buy, you know, like a 5 or 10 gigabyte, 8 gigabyte flash drive or something like that. And then they can fill up whatever music on that flash drive, and the flash drive will cost like $30 or something like that. I mean, they could have been doing that, but no, they went all in on albums. And if anything, it, you know, what I think the internet did show was that most people bought albums just because that was the only thing being put out there. Singles weren't that popular. I mean, in terms of, you know, sales, when, you know, it was easier to just, because most record stores, you could probably, you know, confirm this in the 80s and 90s, at least, didn't really have like a, you know, huge singles section. You know, I remember
going. No, I mean, we had this great record store in the town that I grew up in called Something Records.
That's a great place.
It was.
Nationwide chain, yes.
It was not a nationwide chain. It was this one, and it was really famous, really, from where I'm from, because it was
so famous that it awed you into
yes, it awed, you know, I was so awestruck by all the records. Roy Rogers, I don't know, I can't remember, but anywho, we used to go in there and get, they had a lot of singles, but from, like, you know, the Oak Ridge Boys and stuff.
Yeah. Like, the only time I remember a single was going into Target as a kid and, you know, seeing, like, Cessner, like, ooh, wow, this is a dollar? This whole cassette is a dollar? And then you find out it's two songs.
Right. Remember this cassette singles? Yeah.
Like,
singles.
Yeah. I like the, like, brought up this song on last year when I was doing Tim's Tremendous Tapes, but I bought a Paul McCartney single. That's how I first became aware of that song, Hope of Deliverance, that I featured on the show.
That was the B-side?
No, it was the A-side. The B-side was this little ditty he put together with Linda about getting revenge on a lady who had furs.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah, they're both hardcore, like, vegans.
Right.
In Linda's case, was. But, yeah, like, sing... It,
and then Heather Mills is also...
Or...
Was.
Yeah, was. By... Anyway. But, yeah, like, once I saw, like, the fact that I just got this small cassette with two songs on it, it was... Yeah, I mean, I could not picture myself having like hundreds of those with just one or two songs on there. It made no sense. And so you had to stick with the albums. You had to buy an album that you knew would have one or two songs that you would really love, but the rest were garbage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so anyway, back to Dolly. Like I said, I highly respect her for doing this. In a lot of ways, this reminds me of what Pat Boone did in the 90s. Do you remember that rock and roll album he put out?
No, I don't remember a rock and roll album from Pat Boone in the 90s.
Yeah, it was called No More Mr. Nice Guy. It was him covering just hard rock and metal songs, but in his
own
way.
That's bizarre. How have I never heard of this?
It should be out there on streaming, but I remember Howard Stern when, because Pat Boone came on the Howard Stern show, and to Pat Boone's credit, he, at the time, before he did this album, you know, his big shtick was working with, like, televangelists and having his own show on, like, one of those televangelist networks.
Mm-hmm.
Him doing this album lost him those jobs. You know, but he came of the mindset of, this is music, and this is a way to be able to connect with people that, you know, you may not necessarily understand them. You know, he was thinking of it of an empathetic way. And even though the results are not that good, it's the same spirit. And I respect that. He came, and Dolly Parton came, with a full reverence for the history of rock music and decided to put their stamp on it. And I totally respect that and would, you know, support any artist doing something similar.
Well, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself, Tim.
I know. I'm sad. You know, what is that quote from Blazing Saddles? I sound as pretty as a $20 whore. Anyways.
What's been going on with you, Tim? What would you like to tell us about?
Interesting week here. The other day, was able to catch the first of the three new Doctor Who specials.
Nice.
Russell T. Davies, the guy who is responsible for creating the British version of Queer as Folk, was also the guy who in 2005 was able to help revive Doctor Who. Russell T. Davies is back on the show. And for these specials, they were able to get the 10th Doctor to reprise the role of the Doctor. So David Tennant's back, and Catherine Tate is back as Donna Noble, and it was a fun reunion. It's not an episode that will be so good that it will convert people that are not fans of Doctor Who. You know, and a lot of...
Will any of the episodes of Doctor Who do that?
Yes, but not for everybody. That's true. You know,
I mean, I guess you can't say that of any show that they would have something that everybody would like, but Doctor Who does seem to be its own flavor.
It is a unique show, but you know, I've been watching it ever since the early 80s, so
wow,
it's definitely been something that's a part of my life entertainment wise
Yeah. So
definitely recommend checking that out. And also got a chance to watch Survivor Series, the WWE's premium live event.
Nice.
Yeah.
How did you get to watch this, Tim?
I saw it on the cock.
On the Peacock?
Yes.
The PC okay?
The wonderfully named app from NBC, Comcast, Universal, whatever the hell they call themselves. It was an interesting show. Now, going into it, the show was held in Chicago. And going into it, you know, there were a lot of rumors beforehand that, you know, we would see, a Chicago native, CM Punk. I mean, do you remember me talking about CM Punk with his AEW run on the show?
Yeah.
Yeah. Earlier this year, CM Punk was in a physical altercation with another wrestler, and AEW decided to fire him. And, because of that, going up into the Survivor Series, the WWE made it a point to reach out to the wrestling media and talked to them and said, you know, hey, we have no interest in what, you know, in bringing him back. And what we are doing right now is kind of setting the stage for a returning wrestler, Randy Orton, a guy who got started right along with John Cena back in the early 2000s. He made his return at the Survivor Series, which was awesome to see because he had been out for about a year and a half with back surgery. And surgery that at first they suspected he might not be back. So it was awesome being able to see him back. But yeah, all of the wrestling websites were saying, you know, it's, WWE saying it's not going to happen, you know, so it ended up watching the show. The last match was the men's War Games match. And, you know, Randy Orton ends up being the last person to come out. Cody Rhodes ends up getting the pin, which was awesome because this was Cody Rhodes' first War Games match. And back in 1987, his father, Dusty Rhodes, created the War Games match. So it's kind of a full circle moment. You know, so he got to be able to honor his father there. And so watching it and, you know, thought that was a cool moment. The camera pulls back and, you know, you see like the before, because the War Games match is a steel cage surrounding two rings put together. So the camera goes back, the copyright notice, that shows up at the end of, any TV show, and copyright, whatever, caught up. I grab the remote, then CM Punk's music hits, and everybody seeing that, whether at home or in that arena, freaked out. Like, that music hit, and I immediately jumped up from the couch, and I'm like, holy fucking shit, they did it, yes, 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 and I'm screaming. The cats ran out of the room, they didn't know what the fuck I was doing. I stopped pretty quickly, but then I made sure to text you to let you know what was going on, just in case the neighbor, you know, was like, what the hell, you know? They brought CM Punk back. This is a hell freezes over moment because in 2014, CM Punk walked out on the company and got his termination papers, the official termination papers, because they had initially treated it as a suspension, but he got terminated on the day of his wedding. And the WWE,
it's harsh.
Yeah, and the WWE ended up funding a lawsuit by a WWE doctor, a defamation lawsuit or something like that against him, which CM Punk ended up winning that. But they're back, and it's all because of AEW. Now, the WWE at this point, like, they understand that he's a handful. You know, like, even though I really, really loved this moment, and, you know, this moment, like, the last time I had gotten up surprised screaming at my TV was about 14 years ago at WrestleMania 25. So the fact that, you know, they're still able to get me, I really loved that moment. But like we've talked about on the show before, you know, he comes with his own set of issues. It's just some of those issues I don't think would be repeated in the WWE. Like, for one, I don't see, at like a press conference situation, CM Punk starting to mouth off about other wrestlers, because unlike Tony Khan, Triple H is about 6'6", 6'7", and built like a fridge. And would also know to cut mics and get security to drag somebody out, you know, if they did decide to go into business for himself. I think there are going to be some things in place that will prevent the stuff that happened in AEW from happening again, but he's also has a long established history of being temperamental too.
Temperamental?
Yeah, believe it or not.
I'm just saying, like, maybe it's a little above and beyond temperamental. I don't know.
For a lot of the stuff.
Temperamental is being like, I want only green M&Ms. Being, you know, assaulting other people is more
childish, yeah. Like, he was trying in AEW to be the elder statesman. He felt he had to carry the other people, and they ended up resenting him a little bit. But he ended up, you know, proving their point by reacting to them in the way he did. Now, a part of me wonders why AEW fired him, but at the end of the day, why have somebody stick around that ultimately doesn't want to be there?
Yeah. I feel that way about relationships.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like a microcosm of life, wrestling is, right?
In a lot of ways, in a lot of ways. But it's created a lot of talk, let's put it that way. And like I said, what I have enjoyed most about this whole experience ever since Saturday seeing that is the fact that it got so many people. Like the next day I went to TikTok and there were tons and tons of videos from people that were in the arena or at home, you know, recording their reactions, and everybody's like freaking out. You had grown men weeping, you know, women were crying and, you know, screaming and all that stuff. It was just insane the reaction that they were, that a pro wrestling angle was able to get out of people.
Yeah. I mean, it's, when you described it to me when it first happened, I was like, not getting it. Mm-hmm. Like, you were like, I got up and I jumped up and down and I yelled at the TV. And I was like, why, were you mad? What was happening? And it's sort of that way with the crowd of people. You know, you showed that little clip to me and the roar of the crowd of people when he shows up, when they start playing his music, right? The crowd goes crazy, like you said, and it feels like a real uncontrollable mob to me when something like that happens. So, you know, I was most interested in the fact that CM Punk was engaging, like, physically with his fans as he was coming into the stadium. And just, you know, he obviously felt really comfortable and the fans seemed to really adore him and everybody seemed to stay where they were supposed to stay and nobody jumped over the barrier or, do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, it's not the 70s.
Like a punk show.
It's not the 70s. People, when they walk in and sit down in the audience of a WWE show, know what to expect these days. It's not like the 60s and 70s where you have grandmas bringing a little pistol in their purse to, you know, fire some shots at a bad guy manager that, you know, got the win, you know, illegally for his client, you know, which may sound hyperbolic and silly, but that has happened more than once.
Wow.
But it is a demonstration. That was a demonstration of just what pro wrestling can do at its best. And that's, yeah, to your point, just create these sudden bursts of emotions, like, oh my God, type of deal, and getting everybody cheering like that. You know, this is like one of those once in a lifetime type of moments. You know, just it happens in sports too. Like 1988, Los Angeles Dodgers, you know, former Detroit Tiger, Kurt Gibson had like massive leg injuries and shouldn't have been in the game, but he, you know, Tommy Lasorda, the manager of the Dodgers, just needed somebody to go up there and swing. And so he hobbles up to the plate, strike one, strike two. Dennis Eckersley, one of the greatest closing pitchers in baseball history, throws another ball. Kirk swings and boom, home run. Nobody expected it, but that audience went nuts. Like, the television camera was shaking. And I love moments like that. Moments like that are awesome to experience.
Sure. I mean, I see where you're coming from. I guess I've never had that experience where I felt in tune with the crowd.
It's all about that.
I've always felt alienated from the crowd.
It's all about that emotional connection. If you don't have that, in wrestling's case, if you don't have that emotional connection, positive or negative, with a particular wrestler, you know, you may enjoy the overall experience, but you're not getting into it as much as people that are there. That are there because they have an emotional attachment to a particular performer. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's like, it would be like you having Emma, a Masterpiece Theater version of Emma, play on TV, and you're getting all into it, and I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, because I don't have that emotional attachment with Jane Austen's works that you do.
Right. Yes. Got you.
Yeah. So it's that, and yeah. I get it. I'll be the first to say it. Wrestling is entertainment at its most base. Very simple. That's why you can go to Turkmenistan, turn on the TV, and watch a local pro wrestling show and get everything that's going on without understanding the language. But, you know, What Happened Saturday is one of those moments that shows the beauty of what this entertainment can do. And that's just make a lot of people happy.
Well, good. I'm glad that a lot of people were made happy by the CM Punk re-emergence.
Yes. Is this where you thought your life would be at 49, talking about pro wrestling?
Not at all. Not at all, Tim.
Okay. Well, how about we send it over to one of our friends at the Deluxe Edition Network?
Let's do it.
All right.
Love to hear from them.
Yeah, hang tight, folks, and hear this message.
Welcome in to Metalhead Journeys. What is Metalhead Journeys? It's exactly how it sounds. It's a journey through the world of metal by a couple of metalheads. Are you thinking of getting into metal? Where do you begin? There are so many different subgenres. What bands are good? What albums are good? We'll provide answers to all of those questions. We'll handle all the research and do all the dirty work by listening to the good, the bad, and the ugly, so you don't have to. Classic albums, new albums, bands no one's ever heard of. Get ready as we'll applaud and criticize with the same passion. This is Metalhead Journeys.
Conflict sucks. I hate dealing with, you know, conflict. If it comes, it, like, with my anxiety being what it is, it makes it really hard to have any sort of conflict with people. So what are your thoughts about it? I think you handle it a lot better than I do.
Well, I don't know. I think that I have an ability to detach that is helpful when trying to deal with conflict. And I think that's a little bit different from avoidance. Like, what I think you're talking about is, I'm going to avoid the conflict. I'm going to never talk to that person again. I'm going to quit this job. I'm going to, you know, whatever. Like, I'm going to completely separate myself. That's avoiding the conflict. What I see is a healthy way to experience conflict is to recognize that you're having a conflict and then be able to detach from what that other person feels, thinks, or does in reaction to you in terms of your own self-belief in yourself, I guess.
Gotcha. This time of year especially, too. You know, we have situations to where high conflict situations and high conflict people will come into our lives. I mean, it could be at an employer. You know, if it's like an office type job, maybe you have somebody that you work with that's a little overstressed because of the holidays and they become a little overbearing at work. Or if it's like a school situation, same type of deal. You know, other students are stressed out by whatever. And, you know, everybody's, you know, nerves are on, all afraid and all that stuff. And so there's potentially going to be conflict. But also, this time of year, most especially, a lot of people do have family traditions of getting together and enjoying the holidays together. And when we have a political situation in this country, the way that we do now, to where everybody thinks that they have to hold the flag for their political beliefs, you're going to have some issues dealing with high conflict people at some point, especially during the holidays, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those are the kinds of relationships, those close relationships, those relationships you can't really easily get out of, work relationships, school relationships, you know, those things that you have to engage in. It can be really stressful when those relationships are challenged, when there's conflict. But there can be a lot of conflict because you're really invested. When it's somebody you can just like, okay, weirdo, half stranger. No, right. That's completely different from dealing with somebody that you have to talk to on a daily basis, for example.
Yes. So what we thought we would do for our main event this week is go back to our good friends at Psychology Today and discuss the article from Dr. Tracy S. Hutchinson. The article is called 7 Ways to Handle High Conflict People During the Holidays. And like we normally do, we're going to go through the bullet points, read those points from the article, and then we will have a conversation about that. So did you want me to start off?
Sure, why don't you start?
All right, number 1, reframe your expectations. Your goal for your time together should be to have a nice time that is free of conflict, rather than attempting to fix the past. An alternate goal could be promoting a positive relationship between your kids and a high-conflict family member. Thus, a successful outcome would be them having a positive interaction, even if your interactions with the same family member have some bumps. And yeah, primarily this article's focus was on, you know, family members during the holidays. But I think this is something, you know, in general, you can keep in mind, too, you know, for something like workmates. You know, you don't have to go out and have a beer with everybody you work with. But as long as everybody is contributing positively to the goal of, you know, keeping the business up and running, then theoretically you should be able to work with people. You know, finding something, even if it's something really small that you grasp onto to keep your sanity, to help reframe everything is not a bad thing, because, you know, sometimes our brains, especially when emotion gets involved, don't want to see those positives.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it makes a good point that you can't force a engagement in fixing the past today at Thanksgiving dinner. Right. So, you know, you're not trying to resolve unresolved issues with someone. You're trying to move forward from this moment and just, you know, try to appreciate something about them.
Maybe these mashed potatoes would taste better if you didn't get that abortion 5 years ago. You know?
Oh my God. Trigger warning.
Sorry. Any more thoughts on reframing?
I'll reframe you.
All right. How about you go on to the next bullet point here?
Okay. Manage the relationship. Do not engage. Focus on the outcome of a particular interaction, not the relationship itself. Engaging and attempting to repair relationships with emotionally immature people tends to be very unlikely during the holiday season or at any other time of the year. Approaching the relationship differently is key. Wow, isn't this just true? Emotionally immature people tend to be very unlikely of being able to repair relationships. So why try with them? Right? Like, if you know the outcome is that they're not going to be able to carry any emotional labor.
Yeah. And I think we...
Why engage?
Yeah. I mean, I think we discussed it in last week's show. The fact that, yeah, if you do have family members that are poisonous to you, why have them in your life just because of the shared heredity?
Right.
You know, there's no reason to be loyal to people who continuously show through their actions that they don't have your best interest at heart.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think that's like the big realization from like my kids' generation, you know. I wish more people in my generation, and I wish I had that mindset, in my 20s of doing, you know, what you could to have the family that's in your life, whether it's your blood family or your chosen family, you know, having those people be in your life and not having someone else in your life just because you have to, just because of a shared last name.
Right.
Yeah. All right.
Absolutely. I agree.
All right. Shall I go on to the next one?
Next one.
All right. Number three, set limits on exposure time. Determine in advance exactly how much time you will need to spend during your visits. Is it a few hours? An evening? Are they visiting you for a week? Once you have this number in mind, it could become a source of comfort. For example, telling yourself, this is only for a few hours, I can do this. To further set limits, consider surrounding yourself with buffers or safer people and family members, i.e. those who are mature or not drinking heavily.
Mm-hmm.
Wise words here, because, you know, maybe there is a situation to where, you know, you do have to connect with a family member for whatever reason. You know, maybe, you know, and this is just an example, I have not done it, but let's say you're part of, let's say your whole family like lives in a particular part of the country, but you don't. So you don't go back to family reunions every single year, but you do on occasion. And there happens to be one family member that, yeah, you don't have that good of a relationship with. You know, it's like you're there to see the other people, but yeah, you can set limits on what you're going to tolerate. Because if you know, you know, like your Uncle Bill is going to be drinking a little too much and then talking, you know, out of his ass about politics, and you know that's going to get you upset, why stick around for any longer than you have to?
Right. Yeah. I mean, and I think that plan of having a plan for how long you're going to stay and, you know, being able to talk to yourself about how little time.
And having the buffers there too. You know, no, because especially if we're talking, you know, high conflict people in family relationships, there's a lot of times where people will know that there is a high conflict situation going on. So you're going to have people that hopefully, cross fingers, will be open to being that buffer person. They can keep an eye on your interactions with that other person. And if they think, you know, you need someone, they need, you need someone to step in to break the situation, then they can be there. You know, they can definitely be a nice psychological crutch too, at least knowing that you have that, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
Kind of like a cat going in a hole.
Yeah, so I was looking over and Tim had to look down to see that little Miss Annie had her head stuck in a hole, a little felt kitty pod, but she just had her head in the hole and it was really cute.
Yep. All right, how about you go on to number four?
Okay, let's go on to number four. The cat's being very cute right now. Okay, change the subject. Remember, you will not be able to reason with the unreasonable. Keep subjects light when the HCP wants to pull you into drama. Be prepared for this and have alternative strategies and interventions when it occurs. Distractions, redirecting the conversation to something more positive, or even introducing a shared activity such as a game, a Netflix series, or a sports game may be helpful.
I could see this being especially effective. You know, I mean, I brought it up at the start of the topic, but when you do have so many people that are openly talking about their political beliefs and, you know, acting like that they have to carry the flag for their political beliefs, this time of year, unfortunately, you are going to have people that, you know, will squabble a little bit more if politics are brought up. But to this bullet points, you know, to what they were saying in this bullet point here. Yeah, if you can change that distraction, if you can talk about a pro wrestling event, if you can talk about sports, if you can talk about what movie, you know, you're going to watch on Netflix or something like that, or put on some music or do something to change that conversation, you can redirect it. Because I think what people tend to forget when they do have those, you know, relative yelling matches about politics is that at the end of the day, this is just another person who's getting information kind of like you do. They may be wrong. They may be wrong, but they're not exactly politicians themselves. They're getting news the same way you are, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, that's the thing about high conflict people is that they can take what is could be a rational or reasonable position, and they're just so unreasonable that you can't have a conversation with them.
And some people like to poke the stick a little too much.
You know? Oh yeah,
you'll have plenty of like, you know, owning the libs is a thing in conservative circles, and there are plenty of conservative people that will try and say, well, what about this? What about this? You know, essentially just the poking you and poking you and poking you to try and get a reaction.
Right. Really annoying.
It is. It is.
All right. How about number five?
Yeah.
Yeah. Number five.
Yeah. Let's do it. Number five. Focus on humor. Unlike that interaction I just gave. Sharing positive or funny family memories may help lighten the mood if things get tense. Photo albums and videos may help others recall these positive memories or trigger storytelling. You know, that's a limited example because, again, the article primarily focused on, you know, dealing with high conflict people in a family, you know, holiday get together setting. But, you know, focusing on humor for pretty much any type of tense situation, if you can crack a joke, that kind of, you know, deflates the negative emotions in a lot of people. I mean, how do you think, you know, like in high school, you have plenty of like people that grew up to be stand-up comedians that were rather short, ended up using their humor as a way to get bullies to not beat them up.
Yeah.
You know, Chris Rock being one of them.
Absolutely. I mean, humor is that sort of resort in desperate moments to something to lighten the darkness, right? Mm. Like, it's not funny unless it's real.
Yeah, and, you know, when it comes to the family situation, you know, yeah, if you can, you know, tell a funny story about a family member, you know, doing something silly or something like that, and if that's what it takes to, you know, get the mood lightened up, then by all means, go ahead and do it. And even if you got to do something silly to get people to get a quick laugh so you can let the tension out of the room, nothing wrong with that.
I think, you know, I think for me sometimes that humor can be difficult because it can be sort of making fun of someone.
Yeah.
Because this is common person. And often we take like negative, what we perceive as negative personality traits and sort of talk about like, wasn't it awful when Aunt Mabel did this because she was so weird and...
Well, I mean, and a lot of times, too, it's kind of like sarcasm, you know, how somebody may say something sarcastic and not necessarily mean it, but if it's told in just the right way, someone else may still believe it anyway. And to your point, yeah, you want to make sure it's the type of story that is not going to offend anybody. Like me, I wouldn't want to, you know, tell a story about how my oldest or something like that was caught, you know, eating food out of the garbage when he was one. Never happened. But, you know, if I said something like that,
yeah,
that would be inappropriate if I did not clear it with them first. If that was a common story that they had no problem with me telling, and I knew this for a fact, that's a different story.
Sure, although I think people can feel peer pressure to agree. Like, people have got to be really into their autonomy and to stand up to a parent who's going to tell a story about them, who says, can I tell the story about you? Don't you think?
You do got to be respectful. Like, I know my mother was not the type that would be. You know, she we mentioned it last week, she was the type of parent that, you know, as a grandparent would give, you know, very young kids a lot of candy that they shouldn't have. And yeah, so she would also come up with stories as well. And yeah, you don't want a conflict with a parent, but, you know, ideally it would be a situation to where, you know, the parent and the kid would have that rapport enough so that the parent would know it was okay.
Yeah.
You know, and not all parents have that. You know, there was a time where I didn't have that with my kids, you know. But, yeah. Yes, like we said with the episode we did two episodes back about the words to retire, you know, it's not about censoring yourself, I guess. It's about knowing the power of words. And if, you know, telling a story about somebody is going to make them feel bad, do you need to tell that story?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. How about you go on with the last even bullet point?
Okay. Take breaks. Taking breaks could mean taking a walk, going outside, or even going to the bathroom or another room to regroup. Taking deep breaths, try inhaling for 6 seconds, then exhaling for 6 seconds, can help reduce anxiety or tension and calm your autonomic nervous system if you get triggered. So this is really good advice. This taking of breaks, getting away if you can get away, taking it in small doses, trying to remember how to feel more grounded, and that feeling more grounded will actually make you feel better. All of these things I think are important in maintaining sort of your ability to get through a interaction with a high conflict person.
Exactly. And you know, breathing can help tremendously. I mean, there, you know, once I started latching onto that myself in terms of what it could do to benefit me, like the other day, Mimsy was acting a bit of a fool. And there was a point, I was like, Mimsy, I said that. And, you know, she just kept on doing her thing. And then I had to just take a deep breath myself to, you know, not let that initial annoyance of the cat acting a fool, you know, take over.
Yeah.
And I think that's what, you know, taking that deep breath can do. So yeah, if you got that relative that's spouting off about something political that you don't agree with and you just feel you have to defend, take that deep breath. And then, yeah, like step outside. You know, if you're a smoker, you have a whole reason to go outside. You know, I'm doing a good thing.
This is why people who have not smoked for years will smoke around their family.
Mm-hmm.
Or sneak off to smoke around their family or whatever, because it's so stressful and you need a release.
And what could be done as well, I mean, is, you know, depending on where this family gathering is at, like if it's a big enough place, why not have a separate room set up to where, you know, you have the family congregating like in a living room or dining room or whatever, but you also like in the basement of the garage have a game room set up to where people can go and break off if they need to. Like, I remember that was kind of like the setup of what my aunt did, you know, with all the family gatherings at her house in Granville growing up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty common to have alternate space.
But, you know, again, the point here is to use that as a way to kind of, you know, just kind of get everything back in balance. And the next bullet point here is kind of a nice way to sum it up here. Detach. Mindfulness skills can help you observe the interaction and detach from it emotionally. If you pull into a conflict with a high conflict person, mentally repeating the words detach, detach, detach can help remove yourself mentally and avoid reacting emotionally. Well said. I mean, I've done this myself many, many times over the years and have had it work. I've also had it not work. You know, I think the important thing, you know, overall with any of these two is to just not really beat yourself up, because we're all human. You know, emotions, when they do kick in, especially if we're dealing with high conflict people and they stir up, you know, intense emotions in you, you know, you can't beat yourself up if you do have that rare instance to where you're just were pushed over the line. You know, obviously I'm not saying get into a fist fight with grandpa, you know, but if you just happen to get so annoyed with somebody that you started yelling at them and then walked off and then drove away home, sucks that happened, but we're human, right?
Yeah. Boy, this stuff is just like more and more difficult to like talk about given how close we are to the holidays. Like, I'm finding it triggering just to talk about this.
I remember that time in 1997, damn it. But that is one reason I think to kind of talk about it, at least in broad terms, you know, like, yeah, we would be assholes if we got into like too many deep personal, you know, family stories about this particular topic here. But, you know, talking about it in a lot of ways, similar to some of what the bullet points have touched upon, is one of those things that if you do remind yourself of it, you know, it's a thing and you know that, yeah, maybe I should be a little more focused on doing the right thing here and not let emotions carry me wherever they may.
Yeah, being aware of our emotions is the first step to being able to just accept them and not be responsive to them.
Amen to that. Do you have any more thoughts on high conflict people, how to deal with them?
Best avoid it, I'd say. You know, this, yeah. You get into this, like, what should you do, only if you're going to expose yourself. And there are great reasons why you might be choosing to do that. I think recognizing that it's a choice is actually helpful, even if you're going to continue to choose to engage, because knowing it's a choice means you're not trapped. You have agency. You still have autonomy, and you can express it, even if you don't feel like you can express it, by saying, I'm not even going to participate with you anymore. Maybe you can express it by relaxing and not reacting to someone. Maybe that can be the way that you can take a small step towards being able to just say, wow, no thanks.
Yeah, I am so glad my family's in Michigan. if I ever got like rich and famous, then I'm sure I'd probably get the invitations to family gatherings again. You know, I don't get them now, thank God. So I don't have to think of reasons to say, oh, yeah, I'm busy that day. I'm washing my hair type of deal. But this is a time of year that's supposed to be for reflection, supposed to be for happiness. Like we mentioned last week, you know, if your focus when it comes to family is making sure that the family that you do have in your life, chosen or otherwise, are the people that are leading you to be the best possible you, then, you know, hey, we're here for it. But we're not in a perfect world either. We're going to run into people we don't like, including people in our family.
Yep.
You know, you don't get the luxury I have, folks. I can ignore those fuckers. All right. So thank you all for listening. Each week we'll have something in this podcast space to entertain your ear holes. Until we meet again, we bid you adieu.
Good night.
Rabble, rabble, rabble.
Subscribe to Friends Talking Nerdy on iTunes, the Google Play Music Store, as well as Spotify. Remember to support Friends Talking Nerdy on Patreon. Goodbye, darling.